You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. For many of us, life before vaccines and antibiotics is hard to imagine, let alone remember. But it has been a mere matter of decades since those seeming miracle drugs were developed. And in that time, we have rapidly reduced the risk of death from common infections and even eliminated some deadly diseases. But the organisms that cause such diseases fight back, evolving ways to survive our biomedical weapons. The UN calls such antimicrobial resistance one of the greatest human health threats in the world. Diane Wirth is Richard Pearson Strong Professor of Infectious Diseases and Chair of the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases at Harvard School of Public Health. She's also co-director of the Infectious Disease Initiative at the Broad Institute, where she studies the evolution of resistance to malarial drugs. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right. When we think about drug resistance, certainly for me, the first thing that comes to mind is antibiotic resistance, things like drug-resistant staph or Clostridium C. difficile, you know, infections that crop up in hospitals. But your work focuses on these protozoan parasites, malaria, completely different kind of organism. How prevalent and how problematic is drug resistance with malaria infections?
Well, drug resistance currently is a major problem. The original best antimalarial drug, chloroquine, is unusable for the malaria that causes the greatest number of cases and the greatest morbidity and mortality. And so the world has been forced to develop new drugs, and resistance has developed to each of these drugs as they've been introduced. So we have today artemisinin combination therapy, so a combination of a Chinese herbal medicine and other discovered antimalarial drugs. But there's already widespread resistance to this combination in Southeast Asia. And we are concerned that that will also occur in Africa and South America, where there are a very large number of malaria cases.
Yeah, I mean, it kills more than a million people a year still, largely children.
Yes.
Do we have a sense of what percentage of those deaths is drug-resistant malaria?
Most of the deaths are people not getting to treatment soon enough. But what we're worried about is the vast majority of the deaths occur in Africa, and we do not yet have confirmed resistance to the artemisinin combination therapies in Africa. But if they were to occur there, it would be devastating. When chloroquine resistance spread through Africa 3 decades ago, the death rate in children went up.
When we talk about drug resistance and the evolution of being able to resist and survive these various different drugs, are there any broad patterns in how organisms do that, or is it different for every species and every drug that they're responding to?
What I would say is there are some broad patterns. The organisms have adapted to react to their environment. So there are mechanisms that provide broad resistance. For example, in tuberculosis and malaria, there's a molecule that's similar to a molecule that appears in cancer resistance. This is a molecule that's able to transport or move the drug away from its target. So that's common in many organisms, and that's a common mechanism. But in many cases, resistance is actually due to a change in the target or the place where the drug attacks the organism. And then that's quite specific to the molecule and the organism.
The molecule that you were talking about in malaria that kind of moves the medicine away from where it's supposed to go,
mm-hmm.
What's its function when there isn't some medicine there trying to kill the malaria? Do we know why it's there in the first place?
We don't entirely know why it's there in the first place, but we suspect it's there to prevent to protect the organism from toxins in the environment. So environmental organisms like yeast that live out in the environment have a large array of this type of protein to protect them, we assume, from environmental small molecule challenges.
When malaria makes this change to become drug resistant, does that come at any cost to the organism in terms of its fitness in other situations? Is there a reason why all malaria isn't drug resistant already?
Exactly. It's a great question. In fact, the balance between resistance and fitness is extremely important to how fast resistance spreads. So in the case of chloroquine, for example, resistant parasites don't appear to be different when you grow them in the laboratory. But if chloroquine is removed from a population, as has been done in Malawi, you see the return relatively rapidly of chloroquine-sensitive parasites into the population. So there's clearly some fitness cost. And it's that combination of fitness versus resistance and that determines the spread.
Hmm. On the flip side of that, is there an ecological or even maybe a human health risk to trying to eradicate diseases? I mean, in terms of the whole ecology of the system, we have kind of evolved with these diseases over millions of years. What happens if we start wiping them out?
Well, I think many of us would like to try. So, for example, you know, polio is eliminated from the Western Hemisphere. Smallpox is eliminated from the world. And we don't seem to see any immediate effect in human health. Now, whether there would be a long-term evolutionary effect, we can't say. But a disease like malaria affects 500 million people a year. That get the disease. So it's not just death, but it's people who are infected and suffer the consequences, loss of work, susceptibility to other infections. And so we think that eliminating these diseases will take pressure away from the human population in terms of surviving malaria infection.
I mean, in evolutionary terms, there's kind of different ways to eradicate one of these diseases. And the ones that you mentioned, polio, smallpox, have mostly been eliminated via vaccine campaigns. We don't have a vaccine for malaria. That has for some reason, been very difficult.
Right.
Seems to still be several years away, at least. Is it different when you try to eradicate a disease by treating it after infection instead of trying to eradicate it with a vaccine?
I think that is, you've identified a clear challenge. The diseases that have been eradicated have all had vaccines. Malaria doesn't have a vaccine. There is a malaria vaccine that's been in human trials, shows about 50% protection, but that's not enough to lead to elimination and eradication. So yes, it's a big challenge. It's something we face every day. But remember, we have many tools. It's a vector-borne disease, so we can attack the mosquito. We can treat individuals in mass drug administration to sort of prevent disease by using a drug instead of a vaccine. Ideally, we would love to have a vaccine, and it's an active area of research and one that I think is critically important. One of the challenges for a malaria vaccine is the parasite has adapted over these hundreds of thousands of years of living with humans to be able to evade the human immune system by changing the antigens or proteins that are expressed by the parasite in kind of a systematic way. And so it's difficult to imagine a vaccine that would be better than natural immunity, but that's what we need to do for malaria.
Is there, do you think, a benefit? I'm guessing the answer is yes, since you studied the diseases this way, but in studying malaria in terms of its evolutionary history and looking at, as you were just saying, kind of this interplay, how it got to be the way it is because of its interaction with humans, as opposed to just saying, this is the disease, this is how it is now, this is how we are, let's just figure out how to knock it out.
Right. I think understanding evolution in infectious diseases broadly is critically important. These organisms have adapted to humans, and humans have adapted to the organism. So, for example, the sickle cell trait in humans protects against malaria death and to somewhat malaria infection. And so that trait is very prevalent in populations where malaria has an enormous impact on the population. It reaches 25% in populations where malaria is prevalent. And that means that malaria has the same evolutionary effect as a homozygous lethal. If people carry two copies of the sickle gene, they often die before reproduction. So malaria has a very strong effect on the humans, and the humans clearly have a strong effect on malaria. Understanding that gives us a sense of new ways to intervene. So one of the things that we're looking at very carefully now is how antigenic variation occurs, which parts of the molecule or which parts of the parasite can vary dramatically and still not affect the function of the parasite. And instead, we're trying to look at those parts of the parasite that remain constant despite living in the human host. Perhaps these are better targets because these are essential functions of the parasite that can't be changed.
There are examples where scientists think that perhaps evolution to survive a certain disease or the presence of a certain disease in the population has actually resulted in mutations that we now recognize as being beneficial to human populations. I still wonder if there's perhaps a risk that we don't fully recognize yet, that if we get rid of these diseases that have affected, as you were just describing, that so strongly affect human traits and human evolution, if we just start wiping out diseases, could there be some unintended consequence down the road that we don't even can't even imagine yet?
It's always possible, but I would say we now have a lot of data on, because of the expansion of both human genomics and parasite genomics, where we don't see evidence for beneficial traits. One wouldn't call the sickle trait a beneficial trait.
Certainly not. I was thinking of things like, you know, there's this idea that perhaps mutations that were acquired to resist the plague may actually now be related to HIV survival, or, you know, that there are...
It's certainly possible. You know, whenever, you know, this is an ecosystem, right? And whenever you affect one part of an ecosystem, there will be a response. So I can't rule out that there might be some long-term downstream effect, but balanced with that, you know, 500,000 children die every year from this disease. And so I think it's very important that we deal with it in that sense today.
That's Diane Wirth of the Harvard School of Public Health and the Broad Institute. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, what a newly approved treatment for cystic fibrosis tells us about drug approvals in general and about the promise and perils of genetic medicine. Living Lab continues after a short break.